the Jimmy Green, Bill Kobe campaign adversely affected my raise quite a bit. The club was able to raise a substantial amount of money for John East. A good bit of that came from out of state, which you can do in a Senate race. You can't do that in a governor's race. I put a lot of confidence in the congressional club in agreeing to get into that race. I wanted to make it clear, and I did make it clear, that I was going to run my campaign, and I wanted their help to the fullest extent they could give it to me. I don't think I got that, but that's another story. Anyway, the Reagan campaign in 1960 greatly enhanced the club's reputation. That carried through, I think, in 80 when Reagan was elected, John East was elected. North Carolina carried for both, barely, but it did carry for both. And so that propel them into the 84 right. campaign for the U.S. Senate.
Right. Can I ask? I'd be interested in your thoughts about the extent to which the Congressional Club did or didn't quite provide the level of support that you anticipated that you might get.
Well, I don't want to get into a whole lot of that, but the basic problem was that they were running a lot of campaigns at one time, and it was to some extent a joint effort. And you may recall Jesse Helms was considering a vice presidential bid at that time. So we had a team, what they call a team effort, the new team, and it did well for Reagan and East, but not so well for Lake and Kobe. I think probably to be expected when you're running a broad campaign like that. It's not focused as it should be. It just did not materialize, I think, as anybody anticipated that it would. Certainly the money did not materialize.
If there were aspects of that campaign that you could go back and rework, or were there surprising aspects of it that didn't turn out quite as you had anticipated in terms of certain arguments or certain...
Yeah, I would have insisted more on being able to get out and organize early on and get my county organizations in place. And what they wanted me to focus on was getting on the telephone and raising money. Without a lot of help from the club and from Jesse Helms, that was clearly impossible. I couldn't do that against the sitting governor on the strength of my telephone call. So I think I spent too much time early on trying to do just that, raise some money by telephone, and I needed to get out there and get in the traditional way, which they had gotten away from. Mm-hmm. Gone about the business of organizing and getting about the state and meeting the press and things like that.
Sure. Did you have any ties to Reagan and his campaign staff and the ultimate administration?
You mean after he was...
Yeah.
Well, I went to Washington a couple of times and I talked to, there were some overtures. I, of course, met Reagan and campaigned with him as well as Bush down here in North Carolina. There was consideration of a Deputy Secretary of Agriculture position, the same for energy. I think Governor Edwards was the Secretary of Energy that time. I went up and interviewed with both of them, and I didn't particularly care for what I saw up there. It was not appealing at all. I think I would possibly agree to live in Washington for only one thing, and that's an opportunity to serve in the U.S. Senate.
As you reflect back, do you think that in essence the general critique and campaign arguments that you laid out, the platform you laid out, has been sort of proven right by the turn of events? Or?
I do. Yeah. I think so. Mm-hmm. Very, very much so. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm very proud of that. I think my brochure was headlined "Principle Above Politics," and I really believe that. I believe it now, and I think I was able to prove that when I was in the Senate. I worked very closely with the Republicans, to the criticism at times of my colleagues in the Democratic caucus, but I believe that once the election's over, we're there to serve people, not parties. And I believe that when I came on this court in 92 and got along very well with all of my Democratic colleagues here, continue to do so now. That is something that just in general I think is basic to good government, and something that I think we have gotten away from substantially in the last 2 decades. I think some of the things I was talking about in education have proven out in crime prevention, have proven out. I've been sad to see it, but some of my predictions have come to pass.
Let me ask about the state's economy in one respect. One of the central portions of your campaign platform in 80 was vigorous support for tobacco and textiles.
Mm-hmm.
Now, looking back, we can see that what was beginning to emerge in the state across the 70s, especially in the early 80s, was what has now, for example, is represented, say, by the Research Triangle Park and that sort of.
Right.
What was your sense of did you have at the time, were you closely focusing on a shifting economic base here in North Carolina, or did that not really yet press in upon your sense of things?
Well, yes, I was very concerned about both tobacco and textiles because they've been very troubled industries. They still are, and I think the need to diversify is obvious. We haven't found anything yet to take the place of the cash crop in tobacco. The only thing that is close to it is marijuana, and we don't want to encourage that.
Leave that to my home state.
Yeah,
that's
right.
There's a lot of that out there.
Right, right. But we have today, I think, an increasing awareness of the problems in those two industries. I think we've come a long way with some good leadership in North Carolina. Solving some of the problems that are facing those, the diversification. We've brought a lot of good industry in, the so-called clean industry. That's what it's all about. We've got, we talk about enhancing our lives and welfare economically, raising the standard of living, but we've got to remember that there won't be just a standard of living. There won't be any living unless we have a good environment. We've got to protect that. And that is something I think we have not done a particularly good job in since I can remember. Mm-hmm. I can't really say we've ever done a good job in protecting our environment.
Reporters would ask you back, I saw some of the clippings in that campaign, about whether or not there was any impact of your father's earlier campaigns on the race question still at play in mm-hmm. 80. Did it turn out to be that way at all?
I didn't see it at all. I don't remember exactly what my responses were at that time to that type of question. I don't recall getting it very often because my campaign just wasn't focused on it. The issues, the constitutional issues, which is what they were in my father's campaigns, had been resolved, and we needed to go forward together and confront the issues of the day. And not the past, and so really that I saw very little mm-hmm. indication of it. I occasionally I get some indication that one of my black friends would have some problem with an I Beverly Lake doing this or that. And I guess that's understandable. I simply because he didn't know my father. If he knew either one of us, it wouldn't be understandable. But from the standpoint of what he read in the paper about my father's campaigns, that's understandable, I guess.
I'd like you to describe, if you would, the your work in the first couple of years of the 80s, 81, 82. For the state GOP?
Well, at that time I'd been away from my law practice for 2 years and I was trying to earn a living and get that reestablished. I think I've been in and out of the private practice of law about as much as any man in history, and it's hard to get in and it's hard to get out. At that time I was trying to get back in and get reestablished. I think the first thing I did was try to raise some money for the state party as a state finance chairman, and it really had our difficulties then. We should not have to that extent, but we raised some money. We got some good programs in place. One of the things we put in place was a donor program that would get people to Washington to see the president, the vice president, and various cabinet members according to the level of giving. And I went up to see Lee Atwater a couple of times and got in the White House a few times. It seemed about as confused at that time as it did when I was there when Jimmy Carter was. I went up with Bob Morgan one time to see our congressional delegation and went over to the White House, Western Wing, and met the president. And it was a photo op and all that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But it was fun. But I enjoyed Lee Atwater. He was a piece of work.
How are you, in your days there doing the work as state party finance chair and so forth, how did the future for the Republican Party look to you? Were you seeing a number of encouraging signs? Were you not so optimistic?
I was seeing, some disturbing apathy. I think some of that is, understandable halfway through a first term. I was, I think, generally encouraged. I thought things were moving very well with the president and his programs, and they certainly were meeting with quite a bit of success in Washington. So I think generally we were doing all right, except at the state level we had the second Hunt administration, and that was not viewed generally within party circles as a good thing. They were concerned about his acknowledged race against Jesse Helms in the next election for the Senate. So there was a lot of concern, and I think people were generally hopeful. I believe I was at the time. I was hard pressed with raising money. I've never been very good at raising money, I thought, but I like organization better than finance.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What would you have at the time? How would you have sketched the key issues and questions the Democrats were confronting as the party tried to figure out where it was going to go after Reagan's big win in 1980?
Well, I think we were focusing primarily on the Senate, trying to make some significant gains there. We were also focusing a good deal on the upcoming gubernatorial race. The Democratic Party at that time was somewhat fractured. And that, it turns out, was one of the key things that propelled Jim Martin into the governor's office. We saw some early indications of that, of course, with people lining up, jockeying for position. Eddie Knox and Rufus. And there was somebody else in the race, too. I can't right at the moment think who it was, but certainly those two. We, I think, generally were optimistic, and I worked in Jim Martin's campaign and was on his issues and policy staff. Same time, I was Eastern Chairman for Reagan and Bush. It was a busy time, and I think politics took too much of my time. I'm sure my wife does.
Can you tell me the story of the emergence of Jim Martin as the GOP candidate in 84? Did you give any consideration to running again?
Not much. I think it was mentioned. There was some discussion of it, but I wasn't really burning to run again. I needed to recoup in many ways.
Mm-hmm.
But Jim Martin seemed like a very good prospect, a good candidate. He certainly spoke well, and we were able to give him some help in the tax area. That was the main the focal point of his campaign, tax reform and utilities and other things that he was well versed in, and having been a county commissioner and congressman, he pretty well knew government.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He didn't know how North Carolina government worked. He needed a lot of help initially there,
mm-hmm.
particularly with the legislature.
Mm-hmm. In those first few years of the 80s, when you were working with the party, was there a close tie between, say, the work you were doing for the party and the Congressional Club, or was the party emerging as sort of an entity of greater authority to itself.
Yeah,
by that
it was. It was. There was a fair amount of friction between the party and the club in those days. That was one of my big concerns, and one of the things that hurt me when I switched and ran in 80. The club and the party had a real knockdown drag out in 76, as you know, and that carried forward into my campaign.
You mean the Helms-Holzhauser?
Helms-Holzhauser, right. That was a real concern, a real problem. And in the 80s, it was just under the surface.
Can you describe that 76 problem a little bit?
Not really. It grew out of the convention, I think. First the convention in North Carolina, and then at the national convention. The club was supporting Reagan, and the party was supporting Ford. And it was a bitter fight, a very bitter fight. I remember Governor Holzhauser was not allowed to be a delegate. You're well aware of that. So it was... The wounds had not by any means healed, and new wounds were being incurred through the mid-80s, I would say.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned a moment ago that the Democratic Party by this time, by the early 80s, was pretty well fractured.
Mm-hmm.
What would you have said were the toughest issues for the party that were made? You know, what issues were the ones really driving that sort of split, that sort of internal...
You're talking about from the Democratic perspective?
That's right.
I don't know that there were that many philosophical issues. You had two strong personalities that wanted to be governor, and that was the line of demarcation. That was the thrust of the campaign. I don't think it was a very high-level campaign at all. I don't think either candidate... Well, of course, they talked in the usual high-flown phrases of education and economic benefit to the people, jobs, and all of that... many candidates are so adept at, but down deep, I don't think there was any burning issue that either candidate really felt had to be just had to be brought into focus or to the forefront in order to better the state or save the country. I don't think there was any of that in that campaign.
Would you point to the Helms-Hunt 84 race as being any sort of important watershed in the development of sort of American electoral politics more recently, or just part and parcel of a larger trend?
I think that's what it was, and
you're thinking the latter?
The latter. Here again, you had two strong personalities that wanted to win. I think Senator Helms has always been very driven by ideology and philosophy. I don't know many people in politics that can say that to that degree, to the degree that Senator Helms has fulfilled that I think he is always driven by that. I think the main thing that came out of that campaign was the shocking amount of money raised by both sides, raised and spent in a very short period of time, with television primarily. And I think it really brings to bear the power of the electronic media in this country and in terms of determining who will be our leaders from now on. Not so much the print media, but electronic media. Mm-hmm. I think that may have been a watershed in the most significant aspect of that election.
Mm-hmm. One issue that was developing across the 80s was reapportionment here in the state. The Jingles suit was litigated on the question of redrawing state legislative districts. And then more recently there's been a similar sort of question with the Shavi-Reno and the question of congressional redistricting. What sort of views do you remember Republican Party leadership having over the redistricting question back in the 80s and more recently?
Well, I think more recently you've got the first and the 12th congressional districts, and there never has been anything in my judgment to compare with that. So I don't think you can compare the two. The concerns in the past have always been, you know, who's going to get cut out of his cut apart from his constituency. And of course the Republicans have always felt, and I think justifiably so, that the party mechanism here in Raleigh with the legislature has dealt them consistently an unfair share, and I think what happened in the last redistricting was just the culmination of what has been going on for many, many years. This gerrymandering is not new. It's been with us for a long time. It doesn't make it right. I think it probably goes back to the a lot of what more recently has transpired goes back to the one man, one vote decision, and that has had some good and bad ramifications. I think it results in a certainly more minority voice, but it's forced. It's not natural, and it can't, that voice can't, in my judgment, rise to its full potential until it's natural. It's derived naturally, not in a forced context, because there will always be perceived injustice that goes with it, and that has to tear down the ability of the representative to function. But hopefully we can learn from those mistakes and get that natural element of all our people involved without destroying the natural community that needs to be represented. And that's what we've done with certainly Mel Watts' congressional district. He's got no sense of community there.
How would you describe that sense of natural community? What do you have in mind when you say that?
everybody that makes up that community. Every community is different. Every community has its own unique features, I think. And I think every community has something to offer, something that we need. And you don't get it when you have the sort of contortions that we deal with, and the artificial barriers that are thrown up, and people that are placed in office, regardless of race, simply because of either party or an artificially drawn line between neighbors. Those are things that have hindered us, I think, far too long. I think they've hindered the natural progression, the natural development, human development, cultural development that we would have had in this country if we hadn't had some of the militant movements that we've had in this country. Of course, you need that kind of impetus at times, but it doesn't need to be perpetuated ad infinitum. Because if it is, it's going to create a backlash. There's already a resentment there with any militant movement. And if it's perpetuated beyond the point of its original purpose or perceived objective, then it's a detriment. And that's what we've carried forward, I think, way too long in this country. You have neighbors against neighbors because of redistricting. You've got that's just one aspect of it. We've got special interest groups proliferating at just an alarming rate now. Anything they can seize on, and it seems you've got professional handlers out there that come rushing in. Perhaps young people that want to make a career in the public arena, and so they want to latch on to anything they see as a rising tide, as in the ERA issue, you've got women against men, women against women, and we seem to thrive on that type of thing in the sense of feeding a beast within us, not thriving in the sense of what we should be doing, of getting along with one another and producing a viable economy, a viable cultural, social fabric.
You mentioned the ERA. What, in retrospect, why didn't the ERA pass in North Carolina?
Well, there are two reasons it didn't pass. It didn't pass because of a few people in the Senate at that time who were convinced it was wrong and played some smart hardball politics to see that it didn't get passed. And basically it didn't pass because enough people finally realized it wasn't needed. And like a lot of these calls to amend the Constitution, you don't want to just do that willy-nilly. We may have a few too many amendments to the Constitution already. I think ultimately the ERA lost steam. It reached its high watermark here in North Carolina and then died. And I think it will remain a dead issue because many of the perceived ills that... And there were inequities just aren't there anymore. And the mechanism was there, as has proven to be the case, to correct them.
That suggests another question. How do you look back, and what's your sense of the evolving roles of women in state politics over this terrain we've been discussing?
Well, I think perhaps that the evolution is reaching proportions where the men in government need to be looking for another line of work. And I say that in jest, but in looking at my own profession, the law, there's so many women now going into the law. It's moving toward the law school classes are moving toward parity, I think. And the majority of clerks that I've had here on this court have been women, and they're very good. They're good at what they do. So I think the future speaks very well for women who desire to make a career in whatever they wish. I think we are also seeing the natural result of women who are highly successful in their professional careers and want to also to be mothers and homemakers, and they're realizing the real problem there. Marcia Clark, I think, is the most recent example.
Tell me about what happened in what were the ramifications of the GOP gains in the assembly in 88. Did that begin to really make a significant difference over there, or did it?
I think it was probably the beginning of a real push to try to accomplish what has been accomplished with this current session. I can't say specifically. Nothing comes immediately to mind, but I think it was perceived from that election that it was possible.
What did you make of the of Maverick's successful move to replace Liston Ramsey?
I saw it as the fruition of something I almost put together back in 1985.
Which was?
A takeover. We were within 5, maybe 4 votes of taking over the House of Representatives from Liston Ramsey.
In 85?
85. Mm-hmm.
So you're talking about sort of a role as a GOP official?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I worked with a number of people over there who were trying to bring that about, and it was very close to success. I don't want to name any names right now because some of them are still there.
In some sense, was that an analogous? I mean, what followed in '89 in some ways was closely analogous, then that same sort of reorientation of alignments.
Oh yes,
yeah,
very much so.
What are your feelings after the 94 election in terms of the makeup of the House and what's...
I think it's great.
And in particular, I'm thinking, given your history, your personal political history, what kinds of feelings does that give rise to?
Well, it gives rise to a great deal of satisfaction because that is what I was working for. And here again, I'm delighted for my party, but more so I'm delighted for... this, from the standpoint of good government, we've seen that now. This legislature, with the House controlled by the Republicans and the Senate by the Democrats, has worked better together than any legislature that I can remember, even going back to the days when I was in the Senate and beyond that. They have been very courteous to one another, civil, in comparison. And they have worked, I think, diligently and well together toward compromise and toward the betterment of the state, regardless of party affiliation. And that's what they're there for.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's the only reason they're there.
The 1990 Helms-Gant race,
mm-hmm.
did you... What are your sharpest recollections of that contest, which there in the late hours was a pretty close one?
Yeah. Are you... using hours figuratively there, or are you talking about right? And because I have some real heartburn with the latter hours of that campaign because of what happened to me as a result of the Gant-Helms race. But I think it was extremely close until the last 21 days of the campaign. It could have gone either way. I think finally, I don't know whether it was an infusion of money or what it was. The Helms people surged ahead. I seemed to sense it. I've forgotten the exact date, but I was at the Apple Festival up in Henderson County. And Harvey Gant was there. I first met Harvey at that occasion, and he was very euphoric, and of course I think that's the way he campaigns. He's a very effective campaigner, but he seemed to be coming on very very strong at that point, and then almost immediately after that, I seemed to sense a change, and I don't know what brought it about. I think it may have been some ads that were run. Well, for one thing, Senator Helms got back in the state about that time, as I recall. He hadn't been able to do much campaigning until then. That may have been the thing that changed it.
You alluded to certain developments that I don't know about. Are those things that you can...
Yeah, the Helms-Gant race cost me an election in 1990. I hadn't run for public office since I ran for governor, and I was a Superior Court judge at the time.
All right, this is your race for the Social Justice.
And I was running against John Webb.
Tell me that story, please. I don't know the close details.
Okay, we had a good campaign, and I think it was a close campaign, one in which the issues were probably better discussed than in any judicial campaign. You know, they try to force us not to talk about issues, and I disagree with that fundamentally, but... anyway, we have certain canons that we have to try to adhere to. And at the same time, politic, if you can believe that. But anyway, it was a well-run campaign on the part of everybody. And election night, returns started coming in, I think about 8:30. It showed me leading, and that wasn't surprising because early returns don't mean that much. But on through the night, I led, and increasingly it was a narrow, very narrow margin. It was a big turnout. Um, 6:30 the following morning, I was ahead by some 6,000 votes, I think. By 10 o'clock that morning, I was behind by 3. And that was because Durham had finally come in. There were two counties that, strangely enough, political activists had brought legal actions against the local boards of election to force the polls to remain open beyond the statutory mandated closing time of 7:30. The law provides that that can only be extended by the local board of election. The state board of election can't even do it. The local boards have to meet, and if there's a problem in their county, they can extend the time. The folks in Durham reported a massive amount of machine breakdowns, long lines and things like that. They investigated and were in the process of trying to decide what to do about that. They were getting conflicting reports, but there were problems in about 13 to 18 precincts in Durham. Then the Democrats went to Judge Orlando Hudson, a friend of mine, colleague on the Superior Court bench.